Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Honorable Justice Carl A. Walker presiding. Case number 24-1784, AMPMS Chicago versus BEDT LLC.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I am Justice Carl Walker, and I have here with me Justice Ori Paczynski and Justice Michael B. Hyman. And we're going to give each one of you approximately 20 minutes for your presentation. I'd like to have you to identify yourself and also ask the appellant to let us know if you want to save any time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Jonathan Weiss. I represent the plaintiff appellant, AMPMS Chicago LLC. I would like to reserve time for rebuttal. Would it be 20 minutes for argument and then an entitlement to 10 minutes, or would you like me to reserve part of my 20 minutes for rebuttal?
You should reserve part of your 20 minutes for a rebuttal, and you
Okay.
have any amount you want.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure, we have that noted. Okay, yeah, Mr. Hickman.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Corey Hickman. I represent defendants appellees in this matter, BEDT LLC, DFM Management LLC, Lighthouse Lakes Resort LLC, Elizabeth Crater, Evan M. McLean, David Frankel McLean, Bonnie Starr McLean, Tessa K. McLean, Shirley S. Lady, James Owens, Virginia Owens, and Dan McLean.
Thank you both. And now, Mr. Weiss, you may proceed.
Is a case where this is a case where my client AMPMS invested a $200,000 capital contribution into an Illinois LLC
We know the
BE.
facts. We've read the briefs, we've read the record, we've read the
Okay.
operating agreement and the amendment, and the
Then
opinion
I'll.
by the court below. Let me ask you a question to start.
Yes.
In your reply brief, the first argument you make is about Section 8.3. And you state that 8.3 imposes requirements on the right to become a transferee or substitute member, not an additional member, right? You hold to that.
Correct.
Okay. So have you ever read The Hound of the Baskerville by Conan Doyle?
I was an English major, but I did not.
Okay. Well, there's a line in there, but and it's always been used now, but the dog that didn't bark. That's how Holmes solved it. Now, there's a dog that didn't bark here, and I find it nowhere in your brief, either your opening or your closing, and that's 8.6. And I'm sure you're familiar with 8.6. And that
Yes.
defines what a new member is, or additional member is. And it says specifically that an additional member refers to a new person admitted after the formation with two key conditions. It needs unanimous consent and compliance with all requirements cross-referenced in another section. And so that seemed to me to apply to 8.3, since 8.3 does use the words additional member.
I can respond to that, Justice. And it's a fair question, and it's certainly not the strongest part of our argument or one that I would want to emphasize. And I think the reason we mentioned it is because in the other parts of the operating agreement, it refers to transferees and substitute members and distinctly refers to additional members otherwise. So one would think it just in, along the lines of interpreting legislation that there was a reason for that. With that said, it's an operating agreement drafted by an attorney, presumably. And I think your point is well taken. And my focus really is on the other more equitable and contract-based aspects of why AMPMS is in fact a member of BEDT.
Okay,
So,
because
Mr.
what?
Weiss, why don't you go ahead and get to your strongest argument that you said that's not your strongest argument. Give us your strongest argument. okay, I will. A quick introduction, four parts. Is AMPMS a member? They are. Can they maintain individual claims for breach of fiduciary duty? And then we have the arbitration issue and whether Lighthouse Lakes should have been dismissed and whether the
So
case
now,
should have been.
wait, you're giving us your strongest argument right now, and your a part of your strongest argument, what you just said, is that they are in fact a member.
Yes.
My question to you is, well, how do you distinguish that from all the other Illinois cases which have found that they wouldn't be a member because the formal admissions process is found in the operating agreement? And it's clear that a couple of things didn't happen. One is that they never signed off on it. Two, there's no unanimous consent of all the members. So, but you're telling us this is your strongest argument. So go ahead, I'll let
I
you
will get into my
respond.
strongest argument. I apologize for not answering the question directly. My strongest argument, Your Honor, Justice, is that AMPMS acted in all ways as a member. It made a $200,000 capital contribution. It was given K-1s every year since its capital contribution. It was identified in the books and records
But
as a.
the issue isn't exactly that. But let me go to where we're headed, if you are correct, because to me that gets to the essence of where we're going here, because I'm not quite clear where you're going. Because if you are right and you are a member, then there's any doubt that it doesn't go to arbitration. Isn't that then? Under the operating agreement, you have to go to 10-day, you try to resolve it by negotiating. If you can't, I don't know if you tried that or not, but if you can't, then you go to arbitration. So at the very least, aren't you going to arbitration here if we agree with you?
Your Honor, if you agree, there is an argument that it can go to arbitration. The reason we filed this as a lawsuit and not as an arbitration action is because the arbitration clause talks about issues that arise out of the operating agreement. And in this case, I think issues arose that didn't necessarily arise out of the operating agreement. One example of that might be the transfer of what is referred to as the TIC property, this real estate in Lake Geneva, to a different entity. Is that an issue that arises out of or relates to the operating agreement? I think that's questionable. Number two, and perhaps the stronger argument as to why at this point in time the case shouldn't be compelled to arbitration is because the defendants made a substantive argument under 2619 on issues that were this action arbitrable would have been within the domain of the arbitrator to decide.
What is
And
that? What is that? Stand. That's not my understanding. The case you cite, is a very different case because it did go to the merits. In this case, any time a party files a case in court that has an arbitration provision, what happens is a motion to dismiss. It's you know that. So that's
yes.
exactly what happened here. A motion to dismiss under 2619. So I don't see how that's different. The judge just ruled on the 2619. And so how did you get into the merits? I don't understand that.
Well, I think we get into the merits because the overwhelming majority of the 2619 motion was with respect to the substantive merits of the case. Is BEDT a member? Does it have a right to seek claims for fiduciary duty? So the merits of the case, and I think the case law is relatively.
But you can't get to that issue unless you have standing, right? So the issue that they raised under 690 was stand, do can you bring this action as a matter of law, right?
Well, that is the
That's
first question. However, I think the answer to that question is one of substance and goes to the merits of the case. And if this whole case is subject to arbitration, that question alone that was just stated would be one for an arbitrator rather than make the decision while we're focused on whether or not
Are
AMPMS.
you saying, Mr. Weiss, that the question of membership should be one for the arbitrator? Is that what you're implying?
If this case is one that is subject to arbitration, we don't think it is. If it were, then yes, I'm saying that that would be a question subject to arbitration. And rather than file a motion to
And you're saying
compel,
that, I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. We're talking about membership.
we are talking about membership.
Well, there's like tons of Illinois cases that say that the issue of membership is decided by the court.
Well, I membership in an LLC.
Yeah.
I think it can be decided by the court, but if the panel were to
Well,
decide,
go ahead. Good. I'm sorry. Let me let you
oh,
finish.
if the panel were to decide that this case is subject to arbitration, one of the primary issues is would be in that arbitration would be whether or not AMPMS is a member.
Why
So,
would
would
that
that be
be
an
an take
issue?
you somewhere else for a moment? Because I want to take you to
Okay.
what I believe may be one of your stronger arguments. And I just want to simply ask you, what remedy are you seeking? Are you seeking reversal outright with direction to reinstate the complaint or remand with leave to amend? What are you seeking from us?
I think we're seeking alternative relief, either a complete reversal or remand to permit us to amend the complaint, which we have never been allowed to do, which has left AMPMS with no remedy whatsoever and allows BDT to keep AMPMS's $200,000 in exchange for nothing. And that's the position that BDT is taking at this point.
So, how do you believe that this court should balance the adherence to the operating agreement's formalities with that total equitable idea that you've just presented?
Right. Perfect question. And the reason the way I think we balance that is to look at the totality of the circumstances and the general case law in Illinois, that even if a written contract isn't signed, it doesn't mean that it isn't enforceable or doesn't exist. And so in this case, there were in fact several newly admitted members that didn't sign. In retribution, perhaps, for filing this lawsuit, the only
Yeah,
member,
you mentioned at least two of them in your
the
argument,
right,
that they're also
and
represented by counsel,
right, correct,
retained
exactly,
counsel, I should say.
and so in this case, for since 2021, when AMPMS made its contribution, was documented as a member, was issued K-1s. There was no issue. And the parties acted in compliance with the contract that apparently was not signed by my client, but acted in compliance with the terms of that contract. And an operating agreement is considered a contract. So despite the fact that it wasn't signed, doesn't mean that AMPMS isn't a member. And I think Illinois law, as a general matter, is pretty clear that even if a contract isn't signed, if the parties act in compliance with it, particularly in this case for several years, and treat AMPMS as a member in the ways that I pointed out in our brief, they are in fact a member and the operating agreement is enforceable and they should be deemed a member.
Okay,
The
so
other
what do we do? But what do we do if that's true? You're saying you don't have to apply. 8.6 says that the executed an instrument accepting and adapting the terms and provisions of the act, the transferee, which is now you and the additional member. So, did you do that?
I don't think I fully understood the
Well,
question.
I'll say it again.
Okay.
I'm going to put in that the additional member has executed an instrument accepting and adapting the terms and provisions of the Articles of Organization and this agreement. That's 8.3. Have you done that? Did
Well,
you allege that you did that?
has it been signed?
I said, have you executed an instrument accepting and adapting the terms and provisions of the Articles of Organization and this agreement? That's what it says.
Well, at this point in time, and this is why we raised the issue of discovery, the defendants have acknowledged that the other quote unquote members that didn't sign are still never denied that their members are represented as members, and that's the reason discovery may be helpful here, because just simply because my client doesn't have a copy of a signed document, and we acknowledge that
Signed by whom?
by AMPMS.
Wait, well, your client doesn't know whether they signed a document or not?
They don't recall, and there's a little bit of history here where that would make sense, because there was a relationship between Dan McLean and my client. So
So why didn't you have an affidavit under 191?
I suppose that could have been possible, but we didn't think it was necessary, because we thought it was so clear that by BEDT treating AMPMS in every conceivable way as a member, that we weren't going to need a 191
But
affidavit
that's your argument. There's two arguments you make, right? I mean, there's one that there's an agreement that one you don't make that. What you say is it's implied that you're implied a member, right? That's the argument you're raising. Am I right?
That's right.
Yeah, right. You're not saying it's in the agreement. You just told me you don't know if you have a signed. So as to the
Now,
terms.
was that your? I'm sorry, just a second. I didn't mean to interrupt. Was that your argument, or was that the court's finding?
I was just going to pull back from that. We are not arguing, an excellent point, that they're a member by implication. We're arguing that they are a member for all intents and purposes by virtue of their capital contribution, how they were treated as a member, and pursuant to the operating agreement. In some of the out-of-state cases that were cited by the defendants, the facts were completely different.
But we're looking at Illinois law, so I can tell you that. Okay. And
Okay.
under Illinois law, there's an operating agreement and you have to abide by that. It's a contract, right? And so you're
Yes.
saying that this contract doesn't apply. Is that what you're saying? No, or yes?
No, I'm not saying the contract
Okay. So if
doesn't
it
apply.
applies, you can't, are you picking and choosing which provision applies?
Are you referring to
8.3.
the we're, well we're saying that despite that provision, the fact that the parties that there's no dispute that a $200,000 capital contribution was made, and I don't there's no dispute that AMPMS was treated in all respects as a member of this LLC, the lack of signature, that standing alone doesn't eviscerate AMPMS's
What's your
membership
Illinois case
interest.
that what's your Illinois case that says it?
It's the marriage of Schlichting, and it's on page 23 of our brief. And basically it refers to what I was saying, that if the parties act and behave in the same way they would as though a contract, which an operating agreement is, was signed, and it isn't signed, it's still enforceable pursuant to its terms as though it's been signed. And that's exactly this situation that we have here.
Okay, I just want to rewind a little bit. You're saying that you believe that AMPMS is a member because everybody acted like it was a member, but they didn't act like it was a member on everything. For example, when they got rid of the TIC property, they didn't consult AMPMS about that at all. That
They didn't
just was a
consult
surprise,
anybody.
right? So they didn't act like BEDT didn't act like AMPMS was a member on everything. They just acted like it was a member on some paperwork, the income tax forms, and taking the money. So the bottom line is you believe that you have to prove that AMPMS was a member to get your $200,000 back. And what, so, or is that all you want, or do you want to be a continuing member of BEDT, including all of its existing liabilities now? What do you really want?
What we really want is to be a continuing member of BEDT with all that comes with. And with respect to the TIC property and the transfer of BEDT's undivided half interest, no one was consulted by that about that. In fact, I mean, this is a little off brief, but we were the ones that found that out and informed defendant's counsel that that had happened. I don't want to, we said what we said about Dan McLean and the person that we're dealing with here and the type of person that the First District in the past has found him to be. But that transfer was made without any consultation whatsoever with any members of the LLC. And the First District has found Dan McLean to be a recidivist fraudster. And he's been punished accordingly in the past for similar behavior. So, but the short answer, a member in all its respects, not simply it's $200,000 back.
I know you won't be surprised that I'm surprised that they want to be a full member of something that's run by a guy who's a federal court has found to be a fraudster. I'm just surprised at that. You're probably not surprised that I'm
Yeah,
surprised at that.
there's a related case that's also before Judge Cohen, and there are various reasons that it's important that it remain a member. So,
Okay,
and
but those
it,
cases have
yeah.
okay. Those cases haven't been consolidated, so we're not paying attention to that.
No, the only related.
I just really was curious about what you really wanted, and you've answered that question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Justice Hyman, did you have anything else? He's out of time.
I was just going to say I
Well,
am 4 minutes over, so.
one second. I'm sorry. Did you have Justice Hyman? Did you have a question?
Let me just check one thing. So if we agree with you, you would say the next step would be what? We would send it back to the court. We reverse, but what do we say about the arbitrability? What are you saying with regard to that?
That our arbitration clause was waived because the defendants chose to file a
Okay, you
substantive.
said that, but if we
That's
don't accept that's your only argument.
that, and that the court actually ruled on it, which it wasn't permitted to do under these circumstances. But the only argument is the waiver argument.
Just essentially, he's out of time, but did you have another question for him? Okay, all right. Thank you, Mr. Weiss. We will now hear from you, Mr. Hickman.
Thank you, Your Honors. This appeal concerns primarily a very narrow issue, as you all have recognized. Did the plaintiff in this case meet the requirements of the Illinois LLC Act and the BEDT operating agreement to become a member of BEDT?
But let me ask you a different question.
Sure.
I'm putting you in the shoes of the plaintiff. They pay $200,000. How do they get their money back?
They assert a claim for unjust enrichment or some other equitable claim that they chose not to assert in this case. In this
So
case,
you're saying there are other claims they could make, and whether they're a member or not is that important to those claims or not important to those claims?
I'm not conceding the viability of any other claims, but if I was the plaintiff in this
I'm
case,
not saying you will. I'm not saying you're conceding anything.
sure. I do not believe membership would be relevant to an unjust enrichment claim because that claim was essentially we gave you $200,000, we didn't get anything in return for it, and we should get that money back. But plaintiff made the choice in this case, having two opportunities to draft a complaint to not include any claims for unjust enrichment or other equitable claims. Instead, it asserted two claims, judicial dissolution and
Well, I don't
fiduciary
know if
duty.
there were two. They was a consolidated. They really had one chance. Okay, that's the consolidated complaint. So when you say two, that's kind of not actually correct. So they never got a chance to amend that complaint.
Sure, I understood, Your Honor. But the point that I'm trying to make is
So
simply that
if we reverse on the membership. Then what happens next? And you're this is hypothetical. I'm not saying we are or not. I'm just asking in your viewpoint, what would happen next?
if the court reverses on the issue of membership and finds that AMPMS is a member of BEDT, then the claims are all subject to arbitration, and this case would have to be dismissed or stayed subject to the mandatory binding arbitration clause.
And
Just for
then this
clarity,
would
Mr.
be your.
Hickman, you—I'm sorry,
Go ahead.
just for clarity, Mr. Hickman, you say they've had two chances, but they never had a complaint that was dismissed. That's where Justice Hyman was going earlier, and I just want to make it clear that what happened is that they filed a First Amendment complaint simply to add Lighthouse Lake to this lawsuit. So when you say they had two chances, it's a totally incorrect statement.
Sure, understood, Your Honor. And the only reason that I was saying that is just because we did brief a motion to dismiss on the original complaint. It was fully briefed, and then the amended complaint came after that, and they could have addressed the issues that were raised in the motion to dismiss, which are the same issues that are before the court today and that were in our subsequent motion to dismiss. And they did not amend any facts to address those particular issues that they were aware of. So that's the only reason why I said that they had two opportunities. But Your Honor's point is well taken. I understand there was no ruling on that that first version of the complaint.
This is not, you were asking
So,
questions. Go ahead. I just want to clarify.
if you say it would be go to arbitration, who decides whether it's arbitrable under this agreement?
Well, that would depend on the scope of this court's ruling. If this court ruled that the allegations were sufficient to establish that that AMPMS was a member of the LLC, then it would have to go to arbitration. If the court were to find there was a question of fact as to AMPMS's membership in the LLC, that we need to then I think the trial court would have to hold an expedited hearing and determine that issue to determine whether they are a member of the LLC. And then if they indeed are a member, if they're found to be a member, then it would have to be moved to
So
arbitration.
let's say, it wouldn't go to arbitration unless they're a member. The court found
Correct.
they weren't a member. Therefore, they did what they did. What I'm asking, though, is a little different because what counsel has said is that this may not be an arbitrable issue. Not every issue was arbitrable. It depends on the phrasing of the arbitration clause.
Understood.
So my question was more directed at that, whether we would send it back for the court to determine the arbitrability question, or would that go to, in your if we, in your estimation to the arbitrator or arbitrators to decide?
Understood. And that would be a question for the arbitrator. As plaintiff acknowledged in its own brief, under the Illinois Uniform Arbitration Act, the trial court may only consider the issue of whether there is an agreement to arbitrate in the first instance, which in this case is whether there's membership in the LLC. So once that question is determined, all questions of substantive arbitrability are to be determined by the arbitrator. And we cited a case for that as well in our brief.
So, going to the issue of membership, the agreement has there wasn't a signature on the agreement on behalf of DFM, and that they're attorney in fact, and they have broad powers under the operating agreement to sign various things. So why isn't the plaintiff a member?
Sure, Your Honor. That's a great question. And I did see that argument in the briefs. And there's a few reasons why that argument fails. First, the plaintiff itself was required to sign the amendment, not just the other members. And David McLean, who is the representative for DFM, had the attorney in fact provision, so which allowed him to sign on behalf of the existing members, not on behalf of plaintiff itself, who also did not sign the agreement.
So shouldn't they be allowed to have discovery to find out whether the defendants even gave them an opportunity to sign? Apparently, they don't know.
Yeah, Your Honor, that's the point that I was going to make, is that plaintiff could have sought discovery under Rule 191B before responding to the 2619 motion to dismiss, or they could have simply submitted an affidavit opposing the motion to dismiss, stating we signed the agreement or we were never given an opportunity to sign the agreement. And they didn't do either of those things. And so it's our position that this argument's waived at this instance. And as Your Honor alluded to, if plaintiff did sign the amendment, it presumably would have had a copy of its own document that it would
But
have
even if they didn't, I mean, some people are bad at keeping things.
sure.
But whether they did or didn't, that's not here or there. If they had signed it, it would appear that, considering everything else that happened in the last 4 years, that they would have been a member.
Perhaps, Your Honor, it's our position that not only would plaintiff have to have signed it, but the other members as well.
Well,
Even
why would
if
they have to
I
sign it under the provisions? I think it's 11.1 that talks about. I forget which what, there's a section that talks about the duties of the attorney in fact, and
Sure.
has very broad duties.
Yes, I understood, Your Honor. And well, I don't think there's anything in the agreement that designates how the attorney in fact is supposed to sign a document. It would be our position that there's no indication in the amendment that David McLean was signing in his capacity as attorney in fact on behalf of the other members. There's no notation like you'd see sometimes on a document that says it's
Why would he
signing.
have to? He has a document that says he's an attorney. In fact, he signed DFM, then he assigned it on that behalf. He's given that, they're given that power, right? There's a document that says they're given that power, and you're saying that they still have to put those little designation on there, even though they have the power to do that? Is that the law? If somebody doesn't put those, doesn't say that they can't be considered an executor or any other kind of appointment they get?
Sure, and Your Honor, I think it would depend on his intent in signing the document. But I would also note that the amendment document itself provides on that specific document that it must be executed by all parties here too to be effective, not just by the manager. But at the
Yeah,
end of
but it
the
says that he
day,
can sign on behalf of everybody. It's
you're
clear.
correct. The 11.1 does provide.
So okay, so that's not something the there's not that's not in dispute. So the question is, you have the $200,000, and they want to be a member. They thought they were a member, and the only thing apparently that wasn't done that should have been done is their signature. And that question comes down to you're held to the agreement since it was signed by the attorney in fact. So then the question is, they didn't sign it, but does the law allow them not to, particularly under a circumstance where there's no evidence that they were even given an opportunity to do so?
Sure, and Your Honor, I think that the law is clear that strict compliance is required with the requirements of an operating agreement for the admission of a new member in this case. If you look at the Section
Well,
1.
but Mr. Hickman, just a second, because I don't think I'm going to get a chance to jump in if I don't just in now. I need to know, how do you reconcile your position that they're not a member when everything was done except for their own signature on the document? And I think more so than their signature on the document is the fact that they paid the $200,000. And then we have a situation where they, for tax purposes, they were treated as if they were members. They're listed on the K-1. And now we all of a sudden the position is, despite us listing you on the K-1, despite you being listed on our internal corporate documents as a member, we're going to argue that you're not a member because one thing didn't happen, and that is you didn't put your signature down, even though they've done everything else. How do you reconcile all of that on behalf of your client?
Sure. Thank you, Aaron. I reconcile that again, but you have the language of the Illinois LLC Act and the operating agreement has to have meaning. There's strict there conditions precedent in the agreement that say that they shall be performed. There's case law that says that conditions precedent are
And the
strictly.
one condition, as Justice Hyman said earlier, the one condition that wasn't performed may be the condition that they were never allowed to perform. They were never granted an opportunity to perform.
And again, Your Honor, if that is the case, plaintiff could have raised that in an affidavit. They didn't raise it. Instead, what they did is they stood on their own allegations, which attached to their complaint an unsigned version of the amendment that they could have only gotten from BEDT. So they had an opportunity to sign the document. It appears from their own complaint. They didn't sign it. None of the other members signed it, except for pursuant to the power of attorney provisions, potentially, that Justice Hyman mentioned earlier. And that's the version of the complaint that they chose to file in this case.
So
And they
placing all that aside, how do we get to dismissal with prejudice? Do you believe that was appropriate?
Your Honor, I do believe that dismissal with prejudice was appropriate because I don't see any way for plaintiff to cure their pleading in this case,
But
given
that's contrary to Illinois law, though. Illinois is very liberal in terms of giving a first opportunity to amend a dismissed complaint, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about giving them one opportunity to amend a dismissed complaint. And Illinois almost allows that in I would probably say 98% of all cases.
Understood, Your Honor. And there is a very liberal standard in Illinois, but the only point I was making was there is a futility exception to that when it would be futile for them to attempt to amend their complaint. And in this case, as I stated, the amendment that plaintiff incorporated into its own pleading is not signed by the plaintiff, and plaintiff
No,
didn't.
but even you said at the beginning, my first question was if you were in their shoes, what you would do. And so there is other claims that could be brought. And so they might be able to get a claim together, and there may be discovery later on that will just show that they were never even given that opportunity to sign. Nobody ever asked them. There was no emails, no nothing. And we'll see what everybody else had too. They don't know what the Jameses did, and as we said, we're dealing with individuals who have a record in other cases that may not everything is meets the eye. So in that situation, they're kind of behind the eight ball here. They're out $200,000 that we know, and what the facts are here is important. No, I understand what you're saying. So the question becomes down to whether they've waived it as a result of not filing the 191.
Correct, Your Honor.
Because as it stands right now, Mr. Hickman, there's clearly an injustice going on. Now, how that injustice should be rectified is another question, and probably not a question for this court to even answer right now, but there's an injustice.
Understood, Your Honor, and I'm perfectly willing to admit, as I did earlier in this hearing, that plaintiff may have a viable claim for unjust enrichment, but they're the masters of their own complaint. And they chose not to bring that claim in this case. And it's not the trial court, nor is it this court's job to advise plaintiff as to speculate as to potential claims that plaintiff could assert. They asserted the claims that they did assert, and those claims are not viable at this juncture, given the attachments that they decided to attach to their complaint that show that they did not.
Yes, yes and no, because it all boils down to what happened with regard to that those signatures, because everything else has fallen into place, okay? And with regard, if you treat one party different than all the other members, that's not going to go over well in the law. I mean, that's what they're saying. So they may have other they when we asked when it, Mr. Weiss was asked, what do you really want here? By Justice Paczynski, he said, we want to be a member. So that's why they went down this particular route. They still want to be a member, which maybe they can. That's one of the things we have to determine.
Correct, Your Honor. I totally.
Otherwise, they just get the 200,000 back. So the alternative would be just to get 200,000 back, and whatever else they might be entitled to, and whatever claims they might bring, you know. So, but the other would be they stay a member of what they were offered and thought they were a member of.
Right, and you're correct. I agree with you that the only these the claims that are actually asserted in this case, that does come down to exactly what happened with the agreement and who it was signed by. And the complaint, the version of the complaint we have now attaches an agreement that was unsigned, and there was no affidavit that was presented stating otherwise, and there was no Rule 191 affidavit, which is their right under the Illinois Supreme Court rules to seek discovery before responding to a motion to dismiss. And they didn't do that, and they've waived that argument. Your honors have touched on most of the presentation that I was going to give. So if there's any other questions at this time, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, for the reasons that we've discussed, we believe that the trial court's opinion should be affirmed.
Let me just ask one last question. Judge, it dismissed it with prejudice. What's your argument that there was prejudice? I mean, I know you discussed it in your brief, but I didn't see a valid argument.
Can you repeat the question, Your Honor?
What is your argument that there's prejudice here, that they shouldn't be allowed to? Is what what's the, is there any prejudice of them not of their amending their complaint?
The only prejudice, I guess, would just be the additional time and expense required to
That's
respond
not a
to
prejudice under the law. So, but
under
beyond that, there's
the
none.
other than the futility argument that we made earlier,
Well,
that's
futility, questionable. Okay.
correct. That's the argument that we have in terms of for not being permitted to amend at this stage.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hickman. Mr. Weiss, you reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. You're muted, Mr. Weiss.
Excuse me?
Now we can hear you.
Okay. Just a few points on rebuttal, and one goes to a point that Justice Hyman made, and I think that's it's critical here to consider in terms of the membership issue, in addition to the other points that we've already made, and that is Section 11.1 of the operating agreement. The man DFM, the manager of BDT, did execute that amendment. I assume that wasn't just for nothing. And the 11.1 of the operating agreement does appoint DFM as attorney in fact for all of the members, and specifically gives DFM the right to execute documents that it considers necessary or advisable in connection with the operating agreement, and has full power and authority to do and perform each and every act or thing, whatever requisite or is advisable to be done in connection with the foregoing, as fully as such member might or could do personally. Well, the only conclusion I can come to by DFM, assuming AMPMS didn't sign, by DFM deeming it not advisable for someone who contributed $200,000 to BADT is they wanted to steal the money. And certainly, I think we could say it would be advisable for the newly admitted members, which were more than just AMPMS, to sign the operating agreement. DFM is the manager and an attorney in fact, yet they didn't do what clearly would be advisable. That's
What
point
what's your
number.
response? What's your response to the 191 argument? I mean, we know you didn't do it, and you said you didn't think you needed to do it, but under the law, the fact that you didn't do it, you waived it. So, where does that leave you?
Two things. One, we didn't believe it was necessary simply because of the legal arguments that we made that we thought were fairly clear. Secondly, in their motion to dismiss, the defendants made the point that it was never signed. So rather that we took them at their word under Rule 137 that it was never signed. So that was the second
So
reason.
there is no, so what you're saying now is there's no issue. You're saying taking them at their word that as a admission in their pleading or their response that it is not signed by your client. That is that just what you're saying, right?
I don't know that
You,
for
you said
with.
they said it, and you're taking that up, you're taking them at their word. Did I misunderstand you?
As one of the and I'm not I'm not, I'm taking an officer of the court's word
Right.
under Rule 137 who's and I'm also in addition to that the case law and our other arguments we felt made it unnecessary
Okay, so but
to
if you do
file
that,
one.
you take it's unnecessary, then what you're saying is that you knew that you hadn't signed it.
We knew that we didn't have a signed copy. Yes.
But that's not what they said. They said it wasn't signed by you.
Correct. That correct. That was the
Definitely signed
allegation.
copy.
And we think under all the circumstances that is not relevant for the other reasons that we've stated in her brief.
Well, it's relevant, but you don't think it's under the case law, it's required.
Much better said. Relevant, but under the case law, not right. And also under 11.1, which DFM could have easily. And it's certainly, we're here today because it would be advisable, and DFM shirked that responsibility by not signing as attorney in fact.
Okay. Mr. Weiss, you're out of time. Well, you can go ahead and close, though.
Those were my only points, and for all the reasons that we've argued, we'd ask that the trial court's decision be reversed.
Excellent. Thank you. And we thank you both for your excellent argument. You know the case very well, and we do appreciate that. That's why we try to know the case very well so that we can ask you the appropriate questions. And you both have done an excellent job today. So we thank you for that. Have a good day.
Thank you, Your
Thank
Honor.
you very much.